Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
This is a True Crime in Real Time update. The latest on the biggest cases we're following at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
It's not every day that a federal judge compares your trial schedule to a freight train barreling down the tracks, but that's exactly what happened to Sean Diddy Combs in a Manhattan courtroom this past week. And that line, not just courtroom theatrics. It was a warning, loud and clear, from U.S. District Judge Aaron Subramanian. This case is moving forward no matter how much turbulence the defense team tries to stir up. April 14th was supposed to be just another procedural date on the calendar. Instead, it became the kind of legal flashpoint that only happens when a billionaire music mogul walks into federal court to answer to an expanded slate of serious federal charges: sex trafficking, transportation for prostitution, and racketeering conspiracy among them. Diddy entered his not guilty plea with a straight face, wearing jail attire, and said little beyond the formalities. But the courtroom buzzed. This wasn't just a routine denial. It was the start of what's shaping up to be one of the most closely watched criminal trials of the year. And the judge made it clear, trial starts May 5th. Period. What's different about this new twist isn't just the charges, it's the timeline. The superseding indictment adds fresh allegations, widening the federal case and dragging the time frame of alleged crimes well into the 2020s. But despite that expansion, Judge Subramanian isn't buying any arguments for delay. He didn't mince words. "We are a freight train moving toward trial," he said from the bench. And in legal speak, that's basically a way of saying, you had your prep time, you've had your chance to strategize, and now we're doing this. The government, led by Assistant U.S. Attorney Christy Slavik, echoed that urgency. She made it clear they're ready. In fact, she took it one step further, accusing Diddy's defense of dragging their feet intentionally. According to Slavik, the defense team was slow to enter a plea to the superseding indictment. They waited nearly 2 weeks after it dropped. That delay, she implied, wasn't accidental. It was strategic. She also flagged issues in discovery, particularly with how the defense is handling communications from a key government witness. Apparently, that witness handed over only a curated selection of emails, something like a highlights reel from a massive archive of 200,000 messages. The prosecution insists that's enough. The defense, not even close. Mark Agnifilo, Diddy's lead defense attorney, pushed back. He argued that if you're building a case off of cherry-picked emails, then you're stacking the deck. He told the judge flat out, "The government let the witness select which emails were important instead of asking for all 200,000. His point? If the prosecution wants to play fair, they should cough up everything, not just the convenient bits. That discovery fight set the stage for the defense's next move, a potential request to delay the trial by a couple of weeks. Nothing major, they said. Just enough time to comb through the data dump and catch up with the ever-expanding case file. But Judge Subramanian wasn't exactly moved by the plea for leniency. He set a hard deadline, April 16th. If the defense wanted a delay, that motion needed to be on his desk by then. As of the evening of the 16th, no public record showed any such request had been filed. That's important. It means that, barring any sealed filings or behind-the-scenes maneuvering, the trial is still locked in to begin with jury selection on May 5th, and while it's possible something could change, There's no indication yet that the freight train is slowing down. What's happening here isn't just about logistics or scheduling conflicts. It's about momentum. Prosecutors are trying to keep the pressure on, painting a picture of a defense team that's looking for any off-ramp. The defense, meanwhile, is trying to frame itself as overloaded, not evasive. They've got new charges to answer, mountains of digital evidence to review, and let's not forget, a defendant sitting in federal custody without bail since September of last year. That's another wrinkle in all this. Diddy has been locked up in a federal detention center in Brooklyn for 7 months now. No flashy bail hearings, no ankle bracelets. Just a straight trip to holding after his initial arrest, and every day that goes by adds a little more tension to the timeline. His team knows that. They're not just fighting the charges, they're fighting the optics of a man who built an empire now waiting behind bars. Still, there's no legal precedent that says fame gets you a trial delay, and the judge clearly has no interest in giving Diddy special treatment. In fact, quite the opposite. The April 14th hearing sent a message. This trial is happening, and it's happening soon. Any strategy that involves buying more time is going to need more than a couple of crowded email inboxes to justify it. What makes all of this feel so precarious is how fast the case is evolving. Just a few months ago, this was a 3-count indictment. Now it's 5. The allegations have grown in scope and time, pulling in more years, more incidents, and more alleged victims. And still, the trial date hasn't moved. That's rare in federal court, where cases this large usually drag for years before a jury hears anything. But this time, the judge seems determined to keep the pace up no matter how many wrenches get tossed into the gears. The hearing on April 14th wasn't just about setting a trial date. It was about setting the tone. And that tone is sharp, fast, and mercilessly efficient. The message from the bench was crystal clear. The train's already moving, and if the defense wants to get on board, they better do it fast. There's no slowing this down to accommodate last-minute scrambling. It's also worth noting that none of the new charges fundamentally change the defense's stance. They've been adamant all along, Diddy, they argue, is innocent. That whatever happened in these relationships was consensual, that there's no trafficking, no coercion, and certainly no criminal enterprise. They've made that position clear, and as of now, they're sticking to it. But the more charges get added, the more that argument gets tested. April 16th came and went with that same level of pressure hanging in the air. If a motion for delay was filed under seal, we haven't seen it. If not, then it's full steam ahead toward jury selection in just a few weeks. Either way, the next chapter isn't about delays or court calendars anymore. It's about what Diddy is actually being accused of, because the federal government isn't just alleging a couple of bad decisions or one ugly night. They're laying out a years-long pattern of abuse, intimidation, and exploitation. And in court, they're preparing to show exactly how deep that pattern runs. The headlines make it sound like a scandal. But the superseding federal indictment against Sean Diddy Combs reads more like a blueprint, an alleged blueprint for a criminal enterprise cloaked in the glitter of the music industry. Behind the platinum records, luxury homes, and red carpet appearances, federal prosecutors say there was something darker happening, something systemic, something criminal. And now they're laying it out in black and white under the RICO Act. RICO, short for the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, is usually the kind of charge you see reserved for mafia bosses and organized crime rings. It's a sweeping tool meant to prosecute people who run or participate in ongoing criminal enterprises. The idea is simple. It's not just about one crime. It's about the pattern, the structure, the system. And in this case, the Department of Justice is saying Diddy didn't just commit isolated offenses. They're alleging that from 2004 all the way to 2024, he ran parts of his business empire like a criminal organization, one designed to recruit, exploit, and control vulnerable individuals for sex. The latest indictment doesn't mince words. It alleges that Diddy used his celebrity status, wealth, and influence to lure victims into his orbit, promising them opportunity and exposure, only to entrap them in abusive, degrading, and often violent scenarios. The core of the government's case is built on three words that show up over and over again: force, fraud, and coercion. That's the legal trifecta for federal sex trafficking. If prosecutors can prove that any of those three elements were used to compel someone into commercial sex, it clears the bar for a conviction under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And in this indictment, they allege all three. According to the documents, Diddy allegedly hosted events referred to by insiders as freak-offs, sex parties where women and sometimes male sex workers were pressured or forced to perform sexual acts, often under the influence of drugs or alcohol. These weren't private affairs among consenting adults, prosecutors say. These were orchestrated performances, carefully managed to degrade and control, with the added horror that many of these encounters were recorded. Surveillance videos, phone footage, and images were allegedly used as both trophies and weapons, means to blackmail, intimidate, and keep victims silent. One of the most significant additions in the superseding indictment is the mention of Victim 2, a woman allegedly trafficked by Diddy and his associates between 2021 and 2024. This marks a shift in the timeline from the original case, which focused heavily on incidents between 2009 and 2018. With Victim 2, prosecutors are saying the alleged conduct didn't just happen in the past, it was ongoing well into the current decade. The indictment claims she was moved across state lines for sex work, her compliance secured through manipulation and fear. But it's not just about one victim. The government says there were others, multiple women, some of whom were allegedly drugged before being transported between cities and states. The indictment points to hotels in Miami, New York, and Los Angeles. It details travel arrangements made through third parties, often under the guise of work or appearances. In each case, the women allegedly believed they were there for music industry opportunities, only to find themselves in situations where consent was a formality at best, a myth at worst. Another disturbing pattern prosecutors highlight is the use of violence and threats to maintain control. They allege that victims who resisted or attempted to leave were met with physical retaliation or psychological intimidation. One woman, identified only in the documents as a former employee, reportedly endured repeated assaults and was forced into sexual activity against her will. In some instances, the threats extended to family members. Other times, they came in the form of financial coercion, dangling contracts, housing, or employment in exchange for silence or compliance. What makes this case different from others in the public eye is the infrastructure the government says was built around the abuse. This wasn't one man acting alone, they allege. It was a network. Assistants, security staff, managers, drivers, people within Diddy's organization who, knowingly or unknowingly, played roles in arranging travel, providing drugs, or escorting victims to and from these events. It's this network, they say, that turns a bad actor into a racketeering enterprise, and it's what allows the government to bring a RICO charge instead of a list of isolated offenses. The indictment also alleges that intimidation didn't stop when the physical encounters ended. According to the government, Diddy maintained leverage over many victims long after the fact through blackmail and emotional manipulation. That could mean threatening to release compromising videos or photos. It could mean hinting at harm to careers, reputations, or even physical safety. In some cases, these alleged tactics were so effective that victims remained silent for years, until the recent cultural shift opened the door to speak up. It's worth repeating that Diddy has denied all of these allegations. His legal team has said repeatedly that every relationship mentioned in the indictment was consensual. They argue that the government is taking messy, toxic breakups and rebranding them as criminal acts. They also point out that the new indictment doesn't introduce any new accusers, just new charges based on old relationships. But prosecutors say the expansion of charges reflects a broader view of the same pattern of behavior, one that allegedly evolved over two decades and relied on a consistent formula of exploitation and control. Also of note is how prosecutors tie these alleged acts directly to the structure of Diddy's business ventures, his music label, his fashion line, his events company. They argue that these platforms weren't just revenue streams, they were recruitment tools. Opportunities dangled in front of aspiring artists and influencers who believed they were getting a shot at fame, only to find themselves allegedly caught in a trap that had nothing to do with music or modeling. All of this points to the government's central argument that Diddy's public persona, artist, entrepreneur, mogul, was inextricably linked to a private operation built on coercion. If the prosecution can successfully make that case to a jury, they won't need to prove individual moments of misconduct in isolation. They'll only need to show that the alleged conduct formed a pattern, one that fits the definition of organized criminal activity under RICO, and this is where the stakes get even higher. A RICO conviction carries serious prison time. It's not just about fines or reputation damage, it's about whether a federal jury believes that an empire was built not only on talent and branding, but also on exploitation. With the indictment now public, the government has made its move. The defense will no doubt attack the credibility of witnesses, the motives of accusers, and the interpretation of evidence. But what's clear is that the structure of the charges is no accident. Prosecutors want to show that this wasn't about one bad decision or a few questionable encounters. They want to prove that the alleged abuse was systemic, deliberate, and profitable. And while that battle will unfold in court, another fight is already playing out in the public eye. The civil suits, the headlines, the leaked videos, the character attacks from both sides. What happens in the courtroom might determine Diddy's legal fate, but what happens outside it could shape the way this story is remembered. The courtroom battle is one thing. But for Sean Diddy Combs, the fight isn't just taking place under the fluorescent lights of a federal courthouse. It's playing out everywhere else, too, in the press, on social media, in civil courtrooms across the country. It's a full-blown reputational war, and right now Diddy's legal team is trying to put out fires on every front. Take, for example, what happened in Florida during the second week of April. A man named Joseph Manzaro filed a civil lawsuit against Diddy, alleging a horrifying incident that he says occurred back in 2015 at a now infamous freak-off party in Miami. The story is graphic, and according to the lawsuit, it involves drugging, kidnapping, sexual humiliation, and physical assault. Manzaro claims he was brought to a Star Island mansion, stripped, forced to wear a grotesque mask, and paraded in front of party guests before being abused, beaten, and left for dead. A shocking claim on its face, but what made headlines, at least initially, wasn't just the core allegation. It was the bold inclusion of two unexpected names, Beyonce and Jay-Z. Manzaro's original filing mentioned that the superstar couple was allegedly present at this event. For about a day and a half, that detail set the internet on fire. The idea that two of the most powerful names in music could be anywhere near this kind of situation was enough to dominate headlines, even though they weren't named as defendants. But by April 12th, that part of the story was already walking itself back. Manzaro amended the complaint and scrubbed any reference to Beyonce and Jay-Z. Their legal team had come in fast and hard, presenting what they said was clear evidence that the couple wasn't even in Florida at the time. Jay-Z, they pointed out, was in New York attending publicly documented events. The implication was clear. This part of the lawsuit wasn't just mistaken, it was reckless. In response, Jay-Z's attorney, Alex Spiro, issued a statement calling the original inclusion of his client's name nonsense that erodes trust in the justice system. He wasn't subtle about the frustration. And you could tell that the defense team, both for the Carters and for Diddy, viewed this kind of name-dropping as a strategic ploy for attention. That's where Diddy's team seized the moment. Mark Agnifilo, Diddy's lead defense attorney, didn't miss the opportunity to reinforce his narrative. In the days that followed the amended filing, Diddy's team issued a statement attacking the credibility of the entire lawsuit. They called it fictional, depraved, and emblematic of what they believe is a coordinated attempt by opportunists to exploit a moment of vulnerability for financial gain. The statement painted Manzaro's claims as cartoonish, impossible, and designed purely to get headlines. This is the strategy Diddy's legal team has been sticking to, and not just with Manzaro's case. The consistent theme in their public responses is that these lawsuits are money grabs, that the plaintiffs are bandwagon jumpers piling onto a high-profile man with deep pockets. that the media, especially the tabloid corner of it, is fanning the flames of unverified claims because they're salacious, not because they're true. And in fact, you can almost hear the strategy in Agnifilo's cadence whenever he speaks publicly. He doesn't just deny the allegations, he reframes them. To him and the team around Diddy, these aren't credible accounts from survivors, they're former long-term girlfriends twisting the past to align with a cultural moment. Toxic relationships, they argue, are being rebranded as criminal conspiracies. Messy breakups are now being retrofitted into racketeering narratives. They've also made it a point to hammer the idea that this case, both criminal and civil, is built on exaggeration. In court, Agnifilo has argued that the government is relying on a handful of disgruntled exes using emotional testimony and shocking visuals to make consensual relationships look like coercion. The freak-off parties, for example, are being cast as something more sinister than they were, according to the defense. Were they wild? Sure. But illegal? Involuntary? That's where Diddy's team draws the line. The defense is also deeply focused on the role of media, and they're not shy about saying it. One of the louder points they've made is that much of the public's perception is based on clips and fragments. Bits of video, partial statements, cherry-picked texts. They claim some of the most damaging images being circulated, like the 2012 surveillance footage of Diddy and ex-girlfriend Cassie in a hotel hallway, are taken out of context. Yes, the relationship may have had ugly moments, they say, but it wasn't trafficking. And Cassie, notably, settled her own civil case in late 2023, which came and went with a strict confidentiality clause attached. Diddy didn't admit wrongdoing then, and he isn't now. It's worth mentioning how all of this, every lawsuit, every media leak, every defense rebuttal sits in relation to the criminal case. Because the jury pool for that federal trial is out there watching. Even if they haven't seen the details, they've seen the headlines. They've heard the phrases sex ring, freak-offs, drugging. That's why the civil fallout matters so much. Public perception doesn't just shape reputations, it can shape verdicts. That's likely why Diddy's team is working so hard to discredit the accusers outside of court before those same narratives make it inside the courtroom. They're setting the table. They want to create doubt, not just in the claims themselves, but in the character of those making them. The hope is that when these allegations are presented in front of a jury, they'll be viewed as embellished, financially motivated, or outright false. But that's a delicate game. Push too hard against an accuser and you risk looking like a bully. Ignore the claims entirely and you risk looking guilty by silence. So the defense is walking that line carefully, countering each allegation with blunt denials, casting the accusers as fame chasers or disgruntled exes, and framing Diddy as a larger-than-life figure who's been targeted precisely because of his success. And make no mistake, this isn't just a legal strategy. It's a public relations campaign. From carefully worded legal filings to interviews and leaks, the team around Diddy is fighting to control the narrative because in cases like this, perception is power. And with a trial date fast approaching, both sides are jockeying for control over the version of the story that gets told first and loudest. There's no question the civil cases have multiplied the pressure. With dozens of accusers now having come forward since the end of 2023, each new lawsuit adds a layer of scrutiny and complexity. Some of these claims are similar to those in the federal indictment. Others are completely separate. But all of them help build a broader impression, and that impression is exactly what Diddy's legal team is trying to neutralize. And so far, their strategy has been to isolate and discredit one case at a time. When an accuser's claim includes high-profile names, they push for removal, like they did with Beyoncé and Jay-Z. When someone alleges violence, they question the timing, the evidence, the motive. And when someone settles, they claim it as a kind of vindication, even when the terms are sealed. In doing so, the defense isn't just arguing a case. They're fighting a narrative war, one that unfolds not only in front of a judge, but in the minds of the public, the press, and the future jurors who will be asked to decide whether what Diddy built over the last two decades was an entertainment empire or a criminal enterprise.
The Smiths thought they found the perfect babysitter. Sweet, responsible, a glowing recommendation from the neighbors. She had a way with kids. Calm, patient, always smiling. But what the Smiths didn't know was that their perfect babysitter had been using that same glowing reputation to slip in and out of homes for years, quietly collecting little trophies from every house she entered. Bracelets, photos, sometimes something even more disturbing. If only they had known. If only they had heard the exact type of case like this, broken down on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before everyone else and caught on to the signs before it was too late. Instead, let's just say they're in desperate need of a new babysitter and some therapy. Subscribe now to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.